Hey, deserving listeners, as I will frequently do, I get my best thinking done when I'm in the bathroom. And the other week, I'm in my bathroom, and I'm thinking, oh, what about a podcast episode about this? And all of a sudden, it occurs to me, we should do an episode in which we count down our top 10 favorite animated movies with Birdo and Colin. And so let's do that today. What do you say, the two of you?
Woo!
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor. Who are you, Berto?
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I'm a professional truffle smuggler.
My name is Colin Miller, and I'm just a poor, unfortunate soul.
You got a little Ursula love going there?
Colin's falling for one of the biggest pitfalls of audio podcasting by using a visual.
A visual.
And hoping that people can sense it in their earbuds as they're listening. All right, I'm going to start it off. My number 10 is Spirited Away. It's arguably my number one, but I don't know about the two of you, but I found that when I was making this list, I thought, well, can I even come up with 10 or 15? I came up with, I think, 60 movies that could easily be in my top 10. And so Spirited Away, although if you just would have asked me, you know, if you just would have approached me on the street, of course, wearing a mask and said, is Spirited Away in your top three animated movies of all time? I said, of course. But when I started thinking about all the animated movies I love, it got bumped back. But anyway, 2001 Miyazaki, Academy Award for Best Animated Feature in the United States. This is the first film to earn $200 million in grosses before opening in the United States, which is kind of interesting. Isn't that an interesting fact that the first film to earn $200 million in gross sales before it opens up in the United States? So that includes any foreign movie, right? So there's that. One of the only two animated films ever to receive the Japan Academy Prize for Picture of the Year, the first being Princess Mononoke in 1997. Spirited Away earned 30 billion yen and was the highest grossing film in Japanese history before being surpassed by Demon Slayer, the movie. So I found this to be interesting because, you know, the Japan movie market is really different than the United States, naturally. And I always think of Spirited Away as this gem that some people love that they've seen, but not a lot of people have necessarily fallen in love with or really know. But apparently in Japan, Spirited Away is like their Titanic, you know what I mean? which is just tells you the difference in our markets. But I want to do it this way. So if anyone has Spirited Away on their list, reveal it now and reveal the number.
Do we have to reveal the number or just reveal that it's on
our
list?
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to be here for 10 hours.
So sad because then it destroys the impact.
Destroy away, Birdo.
All right. Well, of course I have Spirited Away, and it is my number 2.
Whoa. I feel like we're playing Stratego, where you just beat my number 10.
But by the way, by doing it this way, it's going to be confusing. Like, wait, what was the... Because you don't have the, like, those horizontal rows of like, here's the number 10,
well,
here's the 9.
But I don't want to talk about Spirited Away three different times.
All right.
So let's just talk about it once and get it out of the way.
All right.
It's your number 2. You could have had more fanfare. You could have been like, oh my God, for me it is...
All right, I'll do it with more fanfare next time. It's my number 2. It was almost my number 1. I'm not going to spoil my number 1 yet. It is definitely like so moving in so many ways. First of all, the animation style of all those movies, you would almost, if we were dealing with animation style, it would almost pack a lot of the slots in my top 10 just with Miyazaki movies. But beyond the animation style, it's like on the surface, a very simple story of a girl and her family, and then the girl sort of like, you know, going through this metaphor of change. But then the complexity of the actual story they're telling, like the literal thing that they're showing us, it's hard. It's very imbued with a lot of that Asian mysticism, Japanese specifically. And then me not being well versed in that culture as well as like that mythology, I found a lot of those things. I saw it when I was much younger, so I didn't even have a lot of exposure. The only other Miyazaki movie I'd seen, I think, was Princess Mononoke, which is a lot more straightforward, by the way. Even though it's got the little spirits in the forest. So when I saw this one, I'm like, man, what a weird thing. Like, they got the bathhouse and all the little spirits, and they got the thing going, huh? but so amazing, so touching. And I was taken for this wonderful, unforgettable ride. Absolutely my number two.
I don't know what it does to my sort of Japanese ancestry. It touches on something inside of me. I can't explain it. The same goes for a lot of Kurosawa movies. There's something, I don't know if I'm just choosing to identify with it or something, but, you know, of course, my grandparents never lived in Japan, so my Japanese ancestry goes back a long ways. So what is it that is being touched upon in my DNA? Is it the feeling, the themes that I saw in my grandparents' house, the themes that I hear in the way that Japanese relatives talk about things? What is going on there? But there's something going on with Spirited Away and a lot of the Miyazaki movies, and like I said, Kurosawa and other movies that just touch something in me. And this movie just has it all. I mean, there's just a beautiful story, and it rides the line, because other Miyazaki movies like Howl's Moving Castle, for example, I think that came out after Spirited Away, and I was really hoping that it would live up to the Spirited Away level, and it didn't, even though I don't really know why it was much lesser of a movie. And I think that what Spirited Away does is it rides the line between weird mysticism, impression. You know, there's certain things where you're like, wait, so the guy, he's a dragon, and he has to, what? I don't understand what's happening. Yeah. You know, it's not explicit. American movies there would be this very explicit thing, like this evil. I mean, even the evil witch isn't necessarily evil,
right?
Especially by the time you get to the end. And so, what's really happening here? And yet, it still feels like a story. You still feel like something is happening, and the world building and the way it slowly unfolds, and how people matter, and the little dust mite things,
yeah,
and just the cutesiness of that whole thing. And it is just a magical, beautiful, meaningful story to me, and I love it so much. Colin, what's your number 10?
Into the Spider-Verse.
Oh.
And yeah, I decided for all of my films, I would write a profound takeaway that I was, because I was like you, Kirk, I had so many, but I tried to narrow it down to ones that just touched me in a very deep way. So with Into the Spider-Verse, the thing that I took away from that film is, don't be too sure about life or who you are ever. Surprise yourself. Because something that I loved about the character of Miles is that he starts to, because he's super smart, he's developing quicker, I think, than his peers. His body can't catch up with his brain. And he starts to decide who he is. And when he goes into his new fancy science school, he's saying, no, I'm not these aren't my people. I'm not a science person. I'm going to get kicked out on purpose. My dad, with, you know, the very law abiding personality, he's not my people. My people, you know, it's my uncle, you know, the person who likes to do installations, art installations in different places, underground, especially. And, you know, spoilers, I guess, for all these movies, you find out, of course, that his dad really, really, really loves him. And there's this amazing scene where he's talking through a door to Miles and telling him all the things, all the ways that he thinks he is amazing, and how he really thinks that his kid has limitless potential. And so Miles sees for the first time, like, oh, my dad does believe in me. Like, he is my people. And the uncle is actually kind of, he's messed up. You know, he's not a terrible person, but he is working for a crime lord. He does try to assault Miles, not knowing it's Miles, but he's, of course, dressed as Spider-Man. And so, and I think that by the end, he has a great arc. And I love when in a superhero movie, it doesn't just show you the powers, show you the spectacle, and then leave it at that. I want a character. I want a person. I want a human being. And for me, Miles was so human, and I loved, I don't know what the kind of animation is. It was very Telltale-esque, obviously better than Telltale, because, you know, obviously one of their things they're known for is being buggy, and it's not a video game, Into the Spider-Verse, obviously film. But that kind of hyper-stylized depiction of New York was beautiful because it highlighted everything. It wasn't like you had boring cityscape or boring bystanders. Everyone was popping with different color, even the grimy aspects of certain areas. They popped, man. I don't know what else to say, but they just popped. And they also weren't afraid of the comic book roots either, because I love comic books. Not all. I think that's a huge thing to say. Like, I love all comic books. I certainly do not. But Spider-Man's one of the few that I actually like to read. And they even incorporated some of the thought bubbles. And I've always thought for years, why do no comic book movies have thought bubbles or narration? It's such a thing. It's a fundamental part of so many comics. And so I just fell in love with every aspect of that movie, and it's my number 10.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything you said. Couldn't agree more. It is my number 21. Birdo, is it on your list?
Oh, absolutely. It's my number 9. And it's, I agree. I had really low expectations. I like Spider-Man movies. But, you know, an animated Spider-Man, I was like, I didn't ask for that. I wasn't like, oh, please make an animated Spider-Man. I had just thought, I think we've made Spider-Man over enough times for now. I could wait a decade before I see another thing. And it blew me away. The story was tight, man. Nice, tight story. It was very refreshing also to see, I guess by its nature, that it was the multiverse. But, you know, it was like the main kid is a half-black, half-Latin kid. That was awesome. And then the characters were hilarious. Like, the humor in it was really good. I laughed out loud a lot in that movie. And I was stressed. There were moments of true stress. And that's good, because in a lot of times in movies, and especially in a lot of cartoons, you're like, eh, it's fun, but it's not stressful. This was honestly stressful. So I loved it.
Yeah, just a beautiful story. Interesting. The fighting was not ubiquitous. You really got a sense for the characters. It meant something. I think there's something about animated movies that frees up writers and directors to actually focus more on the story. I don't know why that would be, but I would venture to say Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is my favorite Spider-Man movie by far. Yeah. And then I was just thinking, my favorite Batman movie is the Lego Batman movie, which is my number 26. I love the Lego Batman movie, and I would much rather rewatch that thing than any of the other Batman movies, for sure. All right, number 9.
Wait, I got to do my number 10.
Oh, you're number 10, yeah.
See, this is why it's confusing. All right, my number 10 is Ghost in the Shell.
Okay.
I love this movie. I mean, I didn't see it in the theater, sadly. I saw it in a VHS, probably, but man, I was blown away because I'm this huge like computer nerd, and I've been tracking these ideas of robots and AI since I was a kid. Just that movie encapsulated so many of those ideas and put forward so many hypotheses. It was like Isaac Asimov on a anime. And then the story is compelling and intriguing and very touching. I also think the animation style is gripping and aggressive. And so anyways, loved that movie.
My number 9, and again, this, it just sounds funny to put this at number 9, it's Toy Story.
The first one?
Yeah, the first one. 1995, same year, interestingly. For me, this movie at the time, if you would have asked me, you know, is this one of your most important animated movies, I would have said no. But looking back, and I think maybe it's a matter of where it lies in history as the beginning of Pixar, the beginning of just all sorts of, I'm guessing this has been said, that Toy Story got animated movies into the adult realm, or sort of the PG realm for adults and kids in this huge way. Prior to Toy Story, cartoons were for kids, you know, but afterwards it seemed like the marketers were like, whoa, we can not only get kids to come to these movies, but we can also get all the adults to come to these movies. So it's meaningful to me in that way. But also just, I love that movie. I could watch that over and over and over again. It's funny. It's heartwarming. It's the Tom Hanks-ness of it all.
Yeah.
And the ending, and, you know, the neighbor kid, and It's just a beautiful, beautiful movie. Tom Hanks recorded his dialogue over a number of years, and listen to this group of movies he was filming at the time: Sleepless in Seattle, A League of Their Own, Philadelphia, and Forrest Gump.
That's insanity.
So while he was working on Toy Story, which is just, you know, it, history books will talk about Toy Story, he's doing Sleepless in Seattle, League of Their Own, Philadelphia, and Forrest Gump at the exact same time.
Two movies that gained him Oscars, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, my goodness. All right, Colin, you're number nine. Number nine.
The Land Before Time. I actually have a very... get under the covers and make sure there's a fan going in your room and make sure the lighting is like low and like not necessarily comfort depression association with this film, but it's actually quite dark. This is, if you haven't seen it in a while, revisit it, because first of all, of any movie that I've ever seen, the quickest I'll ever cry in a movie, you know, just show me like a screenshot from it, or
really
say one line from it in the inflection of the mom. Oh yeah, the mom passing away is still one of the most heartbreaking. Like I might cry just talking about it.
I'm gonna rewatch Land Before Time though, and I'm gonna give you an updated perception, because it has been like, I don't know, 20 years since I saw it or something.
Oh, and my profound takeaway was that family, yes, can be lost, but it can also be found. And I can return to the film's feeling, even as I've made friends as an adult, where I've been blessed. I love my family, my given family, but I also cherish my friendships outside my family. And, you know, friends outside of family do different things for you as a person. And so Land Before Time's a lot about that.
Mm. All right, so let's take a break. When we get back, let's go to our number eights.
Let's do it.
All right, we're back from the break. So, Berto, if Buzz Lightyear was trying to get people to come patrons of the podcast, what would he sound like?
Hello, everyone. I just came back from a mission that took me through many asteroids and galaxies, but the most important discovery I made was that there is an asteroid the size of a sun headed right for us. But there is a way we can stop it. If we all become patrons of this one specific podcast called The Psychology in Seattle, this will incite the aliens to come and try to attack us. But don't worry, because by trying to attack us, they will get in the way of the asteroid. And with their superior technology, they will realize that they need to destroy the asteroid lest it destroy them. And that will save us, because ultimately they will realize that we're all just creatures in this universe. And they will leave us alone, and they will also become patrons of the podcast.
To patrons and beyond, my number eight is Plague Dogs. I'm guessing neither of you have seen that movie. Plague Dogs. It's from 1982, and it's based on a Richard Adams movie, a book from 1977, Richard Adams of Watership Down fame, and it's definitely not. So let me tell you the story of this movie. So my mom would take, you know, us kids to the movies sometimes. And back then, 1982, how do you find out about a movie, right? You just look in the newspaper, and usually there's not much information. It's just like, oh, it's a cartoon or something. And especially in 1982, you figure, well, if there's a cartoon, it's for kids, okay? So my mom takes me and my younger brother, who was even more traumatized by this movie, because he would have been like 4 years old, I'm guessing, four or five. We go to the Egyptian Theater in Seattle, which you know to be not your child movie theater. And we watch Plague Dogs. Plague Dogs, let me just tell you the story. And if you're triggered by dogs being harmed, I would skip forward.
Are there monkey experiments in this movie?
Yeah. Have you seen it?
No, I'm looking at pictures.
Yeah. This movie, one, the animation is not cutesy. It's in that Watership Down style.
Yeah.
And the storyline is there's these two dogs who are in a lab being experimented on.
Oh, my God.
One of the dogs has its skull removed, and they're doing experiments on its brain. And the other dog is being periodically drowned and then revived as a way of trying to learn about physiology. And, yeah, there's these monkeys that are being, you know, just imagine the worst possible experiments you could do on monkeys.
Oh.
And this is how the movie starts, okay? And then these two dogs, they escape, and they can talk. Well, this is very, very much like Watership Down. And they escape, and they're trying to get to safety, but they don't know where to go because, meanwhile, the authorities are after them because they are said to be dangerous or something. And they essentially are going on this adventure, and I won't spoil the ending if you want to watch it, but it doesn't...
I kind of want to watch it now.
It doesn't end happy, let's just put it that way. And so, or it kind of does in a sense as well, but it is, if you like dogs, this movie is like irreversible, the movie Irreversible, you know how like hard it is to watch. This movie is so painful. Okay, I'm 11, my brother is 5.
Oh, jeez. Oh.
And I was old enough to handle it, but my little brother wasn't.
It's traumatized.
But I still love this movie. I've seen it since, and it is a powerful, interesting, beautifully rendered story.
By the way, you were saying that Toy Story really showed that you could make adult animation that could appeal to the masses. I think that's the key, appeal to the masses, because there was a big movement in the 70s and early 80s to make animated movies that were adult-themed.
In the United States, and, you know, of course, in Japan, they'd been doing it for decades.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's a fair point, yeah. But they just didn't do well commercially.
Right, exactly. They didn't do well commercially. All right, Colin, what's your number 8?
This is also a dog one. This is 101 Dalmatians.
Aww.
Yeah. And my profound takeaway is less from the movie, more something that I internalized, is that it's okay to be fascinated by that which you do not agree with. So the reason that that's my profound takeaway is because I'm no longer visual with you guys right now, but right sitting right next to me, waiting to be shown to you, is my Cruella de Vil backpack. So Cruella de Vil is a person who wants to murder many puppies and make a coat out of these puppies that she has murdered. I could scarcely imagine something that I would less want to do, or a person I would have less sympathy for. However, I love Cruella so much. And when I was a kid, I would drape like the covers from my bed, or get like, I had this toy snake and I would wrap it around my waist like a belt, and I'd get those really long pencils that don't make any sense to me, and I'd pretend that they were my long filtered cigarettes, and I'd strut about the house with my grandma's clip-on earrings. And
you pretended
so in
to
a
be
lot of
cruel.
Ways I feel like she was maybe my drag mother. And whoa. I'm like, why was she this? And I realized what it was when I rewatched the movie recently. That character, in every inch of her, within an inch of her life, is a character. She everything, and even not just the way she's animated, but the way she's voiced by Betty Lou Garrison, I think that's her name. The way that she moves, every tiny detail of her movement is oozes with who Cruella is. Her car does, the cigarette smoke, the way people talk about her, the phone she answers, the sound of her phone. So yeah, I love 101 Dalmatians.
101 Dalmatians certainly has a warm place in my heart as well. I remember seeing it as a kid. Berto, what's your number 8?
My number 8 is The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Oh.
Oh,
that's my number 7.
Yeah, now you're talking Colin's language.
Yay. So, I mean, look, Nightmare Before Christmas. I love Tim Burton stuff. And I hadn't really been exposed to something like that. Like, I'd seen claymation stuff before. But the concept was so interesting. It was like, look, we're going to tell essentially what can both be a Halloween and a Christmas movie from the perspective of the Halloween town. And the bad guy is actually kind of like the hero in this one. So it's like a total anti-hero. I just loved it. The animation is amazing with the clay, and the characters are super creative. The Oogie Boogie. What's his name? Oogie Boogie.
Oogie Boogie.
He is scary, man. just a pack of worms and creatures in a burlap sack, like just scary. And then Jack Skellington, the songs, everything was amazing. I remember I got what's the doll's name? What's the gal's name? I forget her name. But anyways, Sally, thank you. I had a doll of her, like one, you know, like a full 12-inch doll of her, because I just thought it was such a cool character. Yeah, so that was my number 8.
Yeah, Nightmare Before Christmas is my 17.
So my profound takeaway, it is my number 7, is embrace the ideas of others when creating. So I didn't watch this movie as a kid. I actually watched it as, I don't know if that's because my parents thought it was some scary thing that it wasn't, because they probably didn't research it further than, oh, that looks terrifying. I guess obviously they would have been proven wrong. But I watched it in high school, and it was a really, and I had in high school a bit of a transition from, oh, I'm a swimmer, you know, and that's what I do, and I have to do everything like that, into, oh, I actually love to act, and now I'm a theater person, which had its own problems, because I started to adapt just all of the stereotypes that, you know, one would if you're struggling with a sense of self. But I think that there is a large part of Jack that really is just that theater kid who really doesn't know what he wants, but he knows that he is wanting. And that's really interesting, because for me, it wasn't ever about Christmas. Yeah, I mean, it is. He loves Christmas, and he basically appropriates the Christmas town culture because he's not listening to anybody. He's fueling his own ego. But I just identified with the arc of somebody who's trying to find a beautiful experience in life because they're not satisfied by what they have, and they've been pigeonholed. That was a big part of the Jack thing for me. Everyone was telling him he's the Pumpkin King, but he had to decide that for himself.
Yeah, beautiful. I was a theater kid, Colin. What's the stereotype of the theater kid? Tell me.
Well, I think maybe it's a little different for me, because I'm a homosexual, and I believe you're either heterosexual or...
You know, I'm straight.
Right, and no shame, no worries. I would say that for me, and again, this is just my association, is flamboyance, histrionic behavior, doing weird impressions all the time of people, even if they're not good, collecting straight female friends and also simultaneously trying to be collected by them. But then I also went a little too far, I would say, in the, oh, I'm also like a bohemian theater person, and I have to dress a certain way so I don't look so much like the nerd that I truly am. Even though that was all, I've never had style, that never worked. But I would always, and then also this idea of I always had to be the one that is diffusing the tension or making jokes. And again, and I just wore the Band-Aid of the theater kid, because I really didn't have great self-esteem. And I also was, because it was harder for me to hide my quote-unquote gayness, even though that's very problematic to say without those quotes, I would never get the lead parts. You know, I was always character actor man, and Miss Oliver was always like, oh, dearie, you can't play those parts. She had like a non-British American accent, but it was like British leaning. And she's like, well, just play the parts that a character, because you're more talented, dearie. And so I was always the old man or the hunchback, you know.
Yeah, that makes me sad. So my number 7 is Mulan, 1998.
Yay!
At the time for me, I was 27, and I was starting to learn how to cry again. I was a young therapist, recently graduated with a master's degree, and had effectively stamped out all impulse to cry at the age of 10, and was setting out to cry again. And as I was saying with Spirited Away, although Mulan is a traditional Chinese story, it's close enough to Japan, or at least far enough away from white America, that when I saw Mulan as in the theater, I remember I saw it in what's now called Sundance, or AMC, anyway, in Seattle, and I cried like literally two-thirds of the movie, even though the crying moments are probably like 5% of the movie, when she would exhibit her honor for her father, I would cry. When the father felt ashamed, I would cry. These kinds of themes are so, again, as I've been saying, in my DNA as an Asian person, that when I see it depicted, which is so rare on the silver screen, it just feels, I don't know, it just moves me. And yeah. This movie was like that. And it's a great movie. It's a great story and funny. And I know there's problems with the Mushu character, but I didn't care when I was 27. I thought it was a hilarious movie. And at the time, it's similar to Toy Story in that before Mulan, you had things like, Little Mermaid, this kind of stuff, which was kind of made for adults, but Mulan was definitely more appealing to me anyway as yep. as a young adult than the other kind of Disney stuff that was coming out. Colin, what's your number 7?
Well, it was the Nightmare Before Christmas. Nightmare.
Oh, that's right. Birdo, what's your number 7?
My number 7 is drum roll. That's a terrible drum roll. My number 7 is South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. I mean, it's, you'd think, well, that's a little bit of a weird choice. You know, the animation style is not the best animation out there. But as I'm sure I don't have to explain, first of all, very much on purpose. It's got its unique charm. And the key thing is this. Yes, The Simpsons had done it. But who would have thought that these, like, ragtag duo could put together a feature-length film that was not only just more of their wacky, offensive laughs, but actually a really touching, good movie with a great story. And to top it all off, it's a musical. And the songs are great. Like, they're catchy, good songs. Like, funny, has heart. So I was blown away.
Yeah. Well, I don't have that, but I do have a Team America somewhere on my list. I have it
which is another number
30. I have it number 30, Team America.
Yeah. Those are puppets, man.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But yeah, I guess that's not really animated.
Well, but if Clay counts.
Yeah.
It's getting a little weirder to decide what is, because people are like calling the new Lion King live action, and it's not
really all animated.
Because you could argue that, you know, Star Wars Episode II was,
oh my god, I was just thinking that.
Yeah, I mean, 90% of the movie is animation. But anyway, all right, so we've done our number 7s, correct? Right. All right, so let's go on to number 6. Okay, so I'm just realizing now that my top 10 are all extreme, like a good half of them are just some of the most depressing cartoons I've ever seen, which just reveals my emo side. Number 6, Grave of the Fireflies. Anyone seen this movie?
Absolutely.
I have not seen it. I've heard really good things.
Yeah, it's 1988, a movie about World War II, directed by Takahata, who co-founded Studio Ghibli with Miyazaki. So it's very, if you watched it, you'd be like, is this a Miyazaki movie? Because it seems real close.
Oh, yeah. I actually had a question for you. So, because I know you might have mentioned it, I might have heard it, but I don't recall at present. Are you the older, middle, or younger sibling?
A middle.
In your family?
A middle.
Middle? Yeah. Okay, so you do have a younger. I feel like this movie.
Yeah.
Doubly impacts anybody who has a younger sibling.
Yeah, 100%. And I actually saw it at my older sibling's house.
Oh, wow.
And so just a little synopsis of this movie, and I highly recommend anyone to watch it.
Oh, yes.
Grave of the Fireflies. It is a movie about World War II. So if people don't know, everyone understands the atomic bombs that were dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, but the death toll from firebombs was greater, much greater than atomic bombs in World War II for the United States. The United States dropped essentially napalm, if not napalm, on the cities around Japan. Now, you could say it was justified or unjustified, but the point is that it burned cities to the ground, and so many people died, and there was so much death and so much so many refugees, essentially, but they couldn't leave the island because they're at war, right? So in this context, which you see from afar from the perspective of two kids, a boy who seems like he's probably like 16 and a girl who, I don't know, maybe he's like 14, and the girl seems like she's like 6, maybe 5, and brother, sister, and they start off happy-go-lucky kids in Japan, and then things slowly deteriorate for them. They end up homeless, they're starving, they get sick, and you're always just pulling for him. You're like, will someone please help them? And you get this really accurate picture of what it would have been like during, you know, towards the end of World War II in 1944, 1945 in Japan. And you just see these two kids suffer. And again, I won't spoil the ending, as with Plague Dogs, but it does not end happily.
It's so brutal, man.
And it is brutal to Japanese society at the same time. Like it points the microscope at Japanese people who did not help these people. You know what I mean?
Oh.
And it's, but it sounds terrible, but it's actually pretty entertaining of a movie.
Yeah.
And there's lots of little moments where, you know, it's the Miyazaki Takahata style of, like you were saying, Colin, about Spirited Away, where the food, you just feel the food. Mm. Well, in Grave of the Fireflies, there's food and there's also candy, and there's you really get a visceral sense for the things that they were coveting as they were, you know, falling more and more into poverty. But Grave of the Fireflies, wow. Wonderful movie. Colin, what's your number six?
My number six is also a Japanese film, and it also is about the terribleness of war and how people can get caught up in it who have no agency, and it's Howl's Moving Castle.
Oh.
I know you mentioned it earlier, and you said it didn't really hold up for you,
yeah.
And that's totally cool. The thing that my profound takeaway from it is that you're most pretty when you see your inner self as pretty, because there's a lot of talk of beauty in the film, and our main character, Sophie, who's one of my favorite, if not my absolute favorite, female protagonist in an animated film, you know, there are several scenes of her contemplating her own self-worth, and she's constantly saying, well, I'm only what people really see in me, and that's a plain house, or excuse me, a plain hat maker. And so you find eventually, you know, throughout the story that couldn't be farther from the truth. And I loved how there's this connection between Howl, who is this magician, I believe, maybe not a magician, maybe a wizard, actually, rather. And he kind of sweeps her off her feet, saving her from some soldiers, actually, that were trying to do very, very bad things to her. And then over time, you learn that he's kind of suffering from the same problem. You know, he has issues of, you know, self-image as well. He's struggling to figure out how to see himself. And throughout the story, you kind of get scenes where both of them are forced into other personas. And not just them, but one of the villains in the piece, or rather villains for a time at least, the Witch of the Waste. You see her transform, not by her own free will, or by her own free will, rather. And so I liked this idea of people having to deal with the reality of their external selves not matching up with their idea of beauty, because I've had to do that. And I feel like it's been a real long journey for me to accept my body as it is, my face how it is, everything as it is. And it's just a symbol for some of the things, you know, that are in my heart, things about me inside, all that external stuff that have kind of adapted that as well. So,
yeah, it's really beautiful.
All right, my number six is Toy Story 3.
Oh, the tough
one. Yeah, I was being a little a little coy when you said if you had Toy Story, because I don't technically have Toy Story 3. And look, I love Toy Story. I love Toy Story 2. I love Toy Story 4. I think you really loved Toy Story 4, wasn't it?
I did,
it?
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
Really love it.
Toy Story 3, I was so blown away because I was not expecting it I was not expecting it to be as good as one or two. I actually felt, I was like, oh man, two ended well. They should just stop. And then, so when they made three, I was like, really? Okay. Went and watched it, and they pulled it off in spades. I was like, wow, this is amazing. But not only that, I was so emotionally moved, and I was in the first two, but maybe it's because I was a little older. That ending, like that whole ending sequence really got to me.
Yeah, God. I mean, really it just me. Kills me.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, really four as well. I mean, even the four yeah. ends kind of happy. Yeah. Yeah. But golly, oh, I mean, gosh. It makes me want to cry just thinking about the Andy giving his... Oh. Well, one, that they almost die, and then two, yep. that Andy gives his toys away.
He has to give his toys away to someone who'll enjoy the toy. Ah. Yeah.
What's the girl's name? Is her name Dora or something?
Molly.
Molly. That's right. All right. My number five is, drum roll, Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Of course. I knew, well, I didn't know it was number five, but I knew it would be in your top 10.
Oh, thank you. 2009, Wes Anderson, based on a Roald Dahl book. You know, he also wrote, did he do Alice in Wonderland? Is that him? Or no, that's Carol. Roald Dahl did, The Witches, like those movies and stuff. Anyway, point is that it's based on a book, a famous book, but Wes
Anderson. Didn't he do that one that Steven Spielberg made with the big ogre or giant dude?
The BFG, which I actually enjoyed as well. I actually
BFG, I think that's Roald Dahl. As well.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I always get Roald Dahl confused with Romnold.
And now I'm getting him mixed up with Lewis Carroll. Anyway, point is that Fantastic Mr. Fox, I love Wes Anderson movies, one. And two, I find Fantastic Mr. Fox to be totally rewatchable. There are scenes in this movie, there's probably... I don't know, 45 scenes that I could just watch over and over and over again. There's one scene, I just want to highlight one scene, where the two of them, you know, the lead guy, George Clooney, and what's-his-face, are riding down the road, and they see, you know, they're foxes, right? And they're riding down the road, and they're kind of like city or sort of suburban foxes. That's sort of the... They live in a home and they live near a farm. Anyway, and all of a sudden they see a wolf, a wild wolf, like on the horizon up a hill. And, you know, both of them look at this wolf. And in my head, I'm like, well, you're both animals. So what's the diff? But to Fantastic, you know, to George Clooney's character, he's looking up and he just sees this majestic wolf silhouetted by the sky. And they just have eye contact, and you're like, what's going to happen here? Is the wolf going to eat him, or what's happening? And the wolf just reaches up a hand in solidarity, and it makes me want to cry. I don't know how Wes Anderson can make me cry from a scene like that, but the wolf, no dialogue, just like, you know, hold up a fist, and then hold up a fist back, and then that's it. Has nothing to do with the plot. It's just a maybe it's in the book. I don't know, but it's stuff like that. That movie is filled with moments like that for me.
The reason I banned that movie and it's not in my top 10 is because I have sore feelings of you and Mitch loving that movie so much.
Why?
Well, so Mitch is my buddy, and Kirk and Mitch, I was over at Mitch's, the place he was living at, and you and him were going off on how amazing this movie was. And look, I am I love Wes Anderson, but I hadn't seen it yet.
Oh.
And so I felt so jealous. And then I watched it. I think I watched it with you guys even, but I think we weren't like fully watching it because you guys had already watched it. So I sort of like half watched it. And then I'm like, yeah, I think it's pretty good, but I don't know why these guys are going so crazy about it. So it's this permanent sore spot for me. It's like, you guys can go have your little movie and F off. But I do like it. I mean, it was really good.
This movie is notable for being one of the few animated movies to be released by the Criterion Collection.
Ooh.
Along with Akita and Watership Down. All right, Colin, number five, what's your movie?
It's the most boring movie on my list. That's probably for sure. It's Sleeping Beauty. And my profound takeaway, yeah, it's sometimes your maternal figures know what's best. So I have grown up with, and I'm sure I've said this on the podcast before, I've grown up with a lot of strong female energy in my life. I have mostly aunts, close with all of them. I had two very strong grandmothers who, in very different ways, both have passed on. And then I have an amazing, exquisite sister and an amazing, exquisite mom. Very close with all. I'm close with my dad too, but there's just a lot of female stuff going on. So I loved the fact that this movie really is just a buddy comedy between these three lesbian fairies. I know they're not canonically lesbian, but I like to think of them as a couple because it's never expressly stated that they're sisters. And so, yeah, you can say, oh, Aurora and, you know, to some degree, the prince, they don't have a lot going on. They're just happy people and they're boring. I get it. But the fairies are fun, and Maleficent is a terrific villain. And I would say that of all the classic Disney movies, it's the most well animated, or at least the one that I find most exquisite to watch, because it's like you are being the whole conceit of Disney, you know, because they started those classic films with the books, right? And then the book opens, and then once upon a time, and then all of a sudden you keep going into the book and the world is there. And I really just feel like Sleeping Beauty feels like you're really, they did something with the camera where you feel like you're moving in and out of a fully fleshed out medieval world where they're not tiny frames. It doesn't feel small. It feels humongous and everything is beautiful. And every single screenshot from that movie is like something I could put on my wall. And I just could go on and on and on about how exquisite the music is, which is from the Tchaikovsky ballet. And as a kid, I think that was my first introduction into the mysticism of the medieval fantasy, which I obviously, like, through my exploration of Zelda, which even though it's not strictly medieval, there are influences, and my love of things like Lord of the Rings, again, not strictly medieval, that was really my introduction into that world. And so, yeah, I don't rewatch it as much as some of the others on my list, but it's absolutely in my heart.
Yeah, it's a good choice.
Man, you're preaching to the choir with that one, because that's on my honorable mentions. So it's funny is when I was a kid, my dad owned an 8mm projector, and he had all these Disney ones that we would watch, but they didn't fit the whole movie. So there were a lot of Disney movies that I never watched the full movie when I was a kid. That included Winnie the Pooh. That included the Robin Hood, Jungle Book.
Wait. So your dad had like 20 minutes of the movie and then it just stopped?
Well, because that's how they sold it. Disney sold the little kind of compressed versions of these movies for the 8mm format.
Oh, but
it's
so
not like
you would,
he sliced it.
Okay, you know? So you would see the resolution of the story, but they leave out a lot of stuff.
Yes, it was told in a way that honestly felt great, especially as a kid. And we wouldn't watch these very frequently. It's like every now and then, maybe once or twice a year, the projector would come out. And it's usually when my cousins were visiting. And we'd turn off all the lights, project it on the wall, and it was like going to the theater. And man, I loved it. And one of the ones we had was Sleeping Beauty. And so, you know what? There were a lot of parts of that movie that I actually never saw until I was an adult. But as a kid, it was my favorite Disney movie because of a lot of things you mentioned. The animation is gorgeous. And that witch, when she turns into the dragon, is one of the scariest things ever. Oh my gosh, love it.
All right, Berto, number five.
Number five is Moana, make way, make way.
Oh,
Moana,
yeah.
This time you knew the village of Motunui is all you. Listen, I had low expectations.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, I'm going to go see. It didn't look like much. Honestly, the posters, I'm like, whatever.
We saw it together.
Oh my God, it was so awesome. It was so awesome. And that's the thing. Like, did you think it was going to, like, let's go see
No,
this
I didn't. I mean, I thought it would be like a kid movie, but it ended up being one of those crossover adult kid movies for sure. And the music, and I, you know, you're a musical guy way more than I am, Berto. And
how do you say that? We're both
musical.
Oh,
meaning,
musicals.
Yeah,
musicals,
like Sound of Music is one of your favorite movies.
That's true.
You love Phantom of the Opera, this kind of stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff.
And I like it, but I'm not into it as much as you are. And to hear your appreciation of the movie through your musical aficionado head, I like it so much more. Because to me, the songs were great, but I didn't really tune into how great they were until you pointed it out.
I see. Okay, well, yeah. So the music to me was unusually good. And like the Tomatoa song is so good. It's the guy from the Flight of the Conchords singing it. And it's just...
Because I'm shiny.
And yeah, and it's super witty lyrics. Yeah. And
Jermaine Clement.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But one of the key things is you had this amazing female protagonist who didn't have a love interest, didn't have any sort of weird... And she wasn't... And I don't mean this... This is maybe tricky to say, but okay. Sometimes some movies try to make a female protagonist by basically doing a role that was designed for a guy to play, and they just swapped in a female. That is not what happened here. She is through and through like a woman, and she's smart and creative and all these things, but they didn't try to make her like some sort of artificial, you know, character or something. It felt really legitimate and true to the culture that they were portraying and stuff like that. And then all the mythology in it, the magic and mysticism, and then that moment, spoiler alert, in the movie where she realizes who the island really is, and then the music quiets down and the water parts and she's walking up and she starts singing the song to her. Oh my, I'm losing it. I have shivers right now. I don't know if I've cried that hard other than maybe there's another movie on my list, but wow.
Yeah, well, all right, on to number four. My number four is Akira, or Akita.
Aha!
1988, I saw this in high school. It blew my mind. By the way, the movie is set in 2019, so we are after the end of Tokyo, or Neo-Tokyo. This movie is pretty, if you know this movie, if you know anime, if you grew up during this time, you understand that Akira is a groundbreaking movie for a lot of reasons. One is that it was the first movie that I think, I don't know the historical significance, but to me it felt like the first anime production that Americans sort of were aware of. Like I remember seeing posters of this around. I remember seeing the VHS cassette in the obscure aisle of the video store. And
it was worldwide, dude. I was in Colombia at the time. It was everywhere.
Okay. Yeah. And it still holds up to this day. And it holds a special place in me and Berto's heart because when we would perform live in our band, I actually would show clips of this movie behind us while we were playing one of my songs. Yes. And I synced up the scenes to this song called Leprosy, actually, I believe that. No, Leprosy would have been Tron. This would have been
Halo or?
Yeah, maybe Halo, yeah. Anyway, and if you don't know Akira, just Google it. It is a classic anime movie, and it's epic in its storyline. It's kind of poignant in terms of the way societies start to break down when you have too many people and too many systems. It's a little confusing in that Japanese way, but not too confusing for sure. They're going to make it into a live action, I hear, soon, which I'm terrified about because it would be hard to... You know, it's like Ghost in the Shell, right? Like, did you like the live-action movie?
No.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of live-action, Colin, did you think Glenn Close nailed DeVille?
I actually did, yeah.
Oh!
I mean, it's one of those things where the character is, in every fiber of her being, animated. Which is like, when something to its core is of a particular medium, you have to change it. But yeah, I loved her too when I was
That's a
kid.
Tough one though, because the cartoon is so particular and Glenn Close could never really reproduce that. But so you sign off on it. That's interesting.
Yeah, I like her. I mean, Glenn Close for me is one of the best actresses of any generation.
Really. Yeah, no doubt. But I would just find it would be hard for anyone to kind of get that magic going.
And oh, they're gonna try with Emma Stone, I guess.
What do you mean? Is another?
Well, she's slated for a Cruella de Vil film. I don't know I don't know if they're doing a Maleficent, you know, the, like what they did with Angelina Jolie. I don't know, but it's, I think it got into production hell a bit, as most things did, because COVID.
Right.
But yeah, I think we should be getting an Emma Stone Cruella de Vil flick down the road.
Wow.
All right, Colin, number four.
By the way, sorry, Akira was in my honorable mentions for sure. It is mind-blowing. It's also another one of those sci-fi fun movies if you're into sci-fi. Oh, so good.
Yeah, yeah. Colin, you're number four.
It's The Lion King. Oh, and my profound... I know, I'm a slut for Disney, but my profound takeaway is... please just send me an extended recording of you singing that song. Listen to the world, because you do not know everything, was my profound takeaway. And there's honestly a lot of superficiality attached to this number four, because I saw it when I was a kid, and my sister and I did all the songs. We would perform little skits. I would do like the Zazu part, and she would be Simba, sometimes Nala. Then she was kind of my stage mom, my sister. I love her.
Wait, and so you were a character actor even in your own house?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I liked to do, well, because my favorites were always the Disney villains.
Okay.
And so, for example, I'm sitting next to a Scar plushie, and I showed you my Ursula plushie earlier. I would do the songs, and as much as a 5-year-old me could do Jeremy Irons, I would like strut around the house and say, "Be prepared." So, yeah, I mean, I can't not have it at number four. I also like, it's one of those things where, and I know you guys have this with Star Wars, but there was an extension of the movie into other mediums for me. Mm, I loved the game. There was a video game, and I can remember all of the toys we had. There was this one that looked like Pride Rock that you could open. The little characters were inside. We had plushies of Simba and Nala. I mean, it was madness. We were Lion King cuckoo, for sure.
Were you one of those families where underneath the television, you just had stacks of Disney VHS cassettes in that very distinctive, you know, the Disney VHS cassette case was like a little bigger than your typical Were you one of those families, Colin?
So much so, Kirk, that I can remember the art design of every single one. I know especially the villains. I know all of the stances. I am not going to bore everybody explaining it, but just know, if anybody wants to challenge me and say, describe that VHS art, I will accept.
I mean, they have that, like, it's the white border, and it's kind of like sticks out a little bit, and then, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, I did a lot of in-home therapy during those times of that very common scenario where, you know, child television wasn't really at its peak the way it is now. And so if you were a parent during that time, you just bought the next Disney VHS, and it was on frequent rotation in the VHS. Birdo, you're number four.
All right. I have a feeling this may not be just me. Inside Out.
Oh, yeah. That's my number two.
I imagined. I knew it was going to be high on your list. I mean, what
I think
can
it's in,
I say?
I think it's in my top 10 movies of all time.
Yeah, dude. Okay, so Pixar in general, I could make a top 10 list with Pixar and not feel that bad about it. You know, like, I'd be like, okay, sad. I left some movies out, but all these are great movies. And yet, as far as Pixar goes, even that one still sticks out, because they had moved me before. Like I said, Toy Story 3, I'm in tears. You know, and I've done that. In Up, man, that whole intro had me bawling. But they tackled a harder problem here, and they did it so well. And it's like that psychology of that girl going through that transition. And for me personally, you know, having moved a lot as a kid and moved at 15, like there was something there. And then the fact that there was that, I didn't know where they were going, honestly, with that. There was that superficial way they could go with the whole sadness and happiness and things, but the way they did it was actually kind of really deep. And so I was like, wow, you need that sadness to make the, wow. And so I was moved to tears emotionally. I was, I thought about it for weeks later. I was still like, man, you and I geeked out on it a lot. Like,
I couldn't, I can't. add to that, really. You described it perfectly. The only thing I will add is that there's a cut on YouTube, or there used to be, of just the real things that happen to the girl. And so it cuts out all the things that happen on, inside the head. And it's still an incredibly moving movie.
Wow.
The storyline of this girl, just her in her life. And I find this movie, it's entertaining, it's funny, it's poignant, it's a world that you've never seen before. I mean, there was that Herman's Head television show in the 90s that was kind of similar, but nothing sort of at this scale.
In a wacky way.
And the moral of this story that happens at the end is quite possibly the most important moral of any story that has ever been told. I mean, maybe it's just because I'm a therapist, but the moral of this story is so profound and so uniquely told and portrayed, and such a gut punch when she finally breaks down and allows sadness to express itself. It's just an incredibly important movie. And at the time, I thought, you know, is this just me or something? But then I actually looked at some of the accolades to 2015, of course, Pixar. It received 15 Best Picture awards by various different, award ceremonies, 21 Best Original Screenplay awards, 40 Best Animated Feature nominations from over 50 different organizations and associations. It won the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature and, you know, various other things. It was also named the seventh best film of the 21st century so far. By the New York Times a few years ago. It's the first Pixar feature film with no antagonist creature. A character, sorry. Written and directed by Pete Docter, who worked on Monsters, Inc., Up, and Soul, and Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and WALL-E. And yeah, the psychology of this movie is just so deep, and yeah, just really loved it. And I'm glad it's in your top five, Berto. What do you think of this movie, Colin?
I really love it. It's up there for me too. I actually was thinking about this movie the other day based on something that you've said in several of the recent episodes of Psychology in Seattle, where people will ask you whether it's about grief or trauma or anger. They'll be like, hey, how do I deal with this? Like, what do I do to essentially kind of like asking to get rid of it? And, you know, you kind of have a similar response to them, and you go, well, like, I'd rather you, I don't want to speak for you, but essentially what it sounds like you're saying is I'd rather you deal with it. Like, it's okay to feel that way. And I was thinking about like, oh, maybe for these people, you know, joy is running amok in their head, and she's still trying to tell sadness, you know, that she's not allowed in the space. And I would say that whole situation of joy trying to monopolize, it's definitely, I love that the movie put that in such a profoundly understandable visual way, something that so many people deal with, and certainly I have as well. I think that's, and also in relationship to people, I find myself being like, oh no, like, don't do the thing, make the behavior that will invalidate you in their eyes, or like potentially upset them. And so it's like all this repression stuff. And so, yeah, I could not be more impressed with the script and also with the animation, because I would say it's one of the most, if not the most, creatively spectacular Pixar film. There's just so much imagination in every frame.
Yeah. And if you just pitch the story, so this girl moves from Minnesota to San Francisco, and she's sad about it. Well, wait. So is there a car chase, or is there a bully at school? No, there's no bully at school. Is the one of the parents dead? No.
But the pizza style they have is different.
Yeah. And she eats a pizza that is organic, and it's not familiar to her, and it kind of bums her out. Well, wait, what? You know, like that's the entirety of the plot, and yet it is so moving. And to have it grounded in such a mundane life circumstance of which all of us suffer, you know, deeply in very uncinematic moments, is just a beautiful choice. And you know that they had conversations where they're like, well, you know, should we make this a little bit more interesting? You know, should there be like a bully? Should there be some kind of problem with the parents? Or, you know, and they're like, no, let's just keep it simple.
But I mean, you could describe Star Wars like, you know, this teenager has his Google Translate tell him that his Roomba is, it belongs to someone else and he's got to take it.
His Google Translate and his Roomba.
But you hit it right on the head for Inside Out, because the quote of Shakespeare comes to mind, like, brevity is the soul of wit. There's no wasted time in Inside Out, whereas a lot of, you know, people were mentioning some other Disney movies where I find that there's a lot of frou-frou, like, you know, just, oh, this is the hijink scene, like in Tarzan, where just the apes just, like, trash the camp for 5 minutes, and it doesn't really move the plot along. And Inside Out is so streamlined. There's not a moment wasted.
Absolutely. Yeah, and the universality of Bing Bong. I mean,
oh my gosh, all don't of bring us up Bing Bong. I will
all
cry.
Of us have a Bing Bong.
The Bing Bong sacrifice. Yep. Oh God.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, it makes me tear up. All right, my number three. We've already talked about it. Princess Mononoke. This I saw before I saw Spirited Away.
Same.
And if I had seen them in the reverse, I'm guessing I would have put Spirited Away higher. But Princess Mononoke was so mind-blowing. I saw it in 1997. So this isn't that long. In my head, it's not that long after Akira. And I feel like it was the first movie of that kind. You saw Ghost in the Shell, Birdo. But for me, Princess Mononoke was like, again, that Japanese DNA that gets touched on as I'm watching it. And just the fascination of it's a little confusing, and you get this sense, it's like with Lord of the Rings, where as you're watching a plot unfold where you have Frodo who has to get to the mountain, you see all these little references to culture in a bigger world. And Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away both are like this, where you see little hints of a bigger world that, you know what, we just don't have time to go into, but you're still going to understand the story, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I just thought Princess Mononoke, and like I said, there are three movies in the Criterion Collection. You have Fantastic Mr. Fox, Akira, and Princess Mononoke, or sorry, Akira and Watership Down. Sorry. I just revealed my number one. That's my number one, by the way. Watership Down.
Dun, dun, dun. I had a feeling it would be because you've talked about it so much, but we'll come back to that. Yeah. About Princess Mononoke, though, because we're only on number three, right? Okay, so Princess Mononoke, although it's not in my top 10, when I saw that, I had the same reaction as you. I feel like at the time when I saw it, I was probably like, this is my new favorite animation movie.
Yeah.
Because it was not watered down. No pun with Watership Down. It was not watered down. It wasn't there were no pulled punches. I was like, wow, this is an adult movie.
Yeah.
Like, this is an adult movie. And that, like, that fictional world it creates was so intriguing.
Yeah.
I loved it. I thought animation, now I only saw the translated, the one, meaning the one with the voice actors that were the U.S. voice actors, but they hired top-notch talent for it.
Yeah. And the dialogue track was adapted by Neil Gaiman. Your friend.
Oh my gosh, no wonder it was so well written.
Yeah. All right, Colin, you're number three.
Finding Nemo.
Oh. So,
yes.
My profound takeaway is you should not live in fear of loss. And I have a kind of strange Inside Out-esque, if you will, association with this film. So I actually think that Marlin, Nemo, and Dory could be read as parts of the same person. Because whenever Marlin experiences trauma at the very beginning of the film, when he loses his wife to a tragic barracuda accident, which does sound funny as I'm saying it, he goes through life feeling like there's a piece of any kind of potential missing. And I feel like Nemo is that piece. He's the forward momentum, the person who wants to go to school, who wants to learn, who has been damaged, has, like, you could say, a disability, but nevertheless has a zest for life. Marlon tries to stop it, halt it, put it in a place where it will be safe. And then you've got Dory, who's kind of the instigator, if you will, who doesn't have Marlon's fixation on the past. In fact, she's the opposite. She has no past because she can't remember it. And so you don't also just get a full-on shaming of Marlon for being a little bit trapped in the past, because there are issues with Dory's take on the world, even though there are things to celebrate about it as well. And so you get this perfect, almost like id, ego, super ego thing going on between these three very well-voiced characters. And I also just have to say, on a superficial level, this is the most beautiful animated movie that I've ever seen. I am biased.
Right, because you're Mr. Underwater.
Because it is underwater. That is why.
Well, but then Ponyo should be right in there.
Well, you know, and Aquaman should be up there.
I put Ponyo as my number 10 first. And I don't know why I removed it. I think it was because I forgot about Into the Spider-Verse and was just like, oh my God, that was a crime. So I love Ponyo too. I would say that, talk a little bit about Ponyo. I would say that that's the calmest movie for me. Like, I will throw on Ponyo just to relax. It is, if you were to say, like, hey, Colin, which movie is your dreamscape? Which movie would you want to project on your, like, ceiling before you go to sleep? Definitely Ponyo.
Yeah,
like, no contest.
All right, Birdo, number three.
Number three is Winnie the Pooh.
Oh.
Winnie the Pooh.
Really?
Specifically, the many adventures of Winnie the Pooh, the classic Disney. It's got several stories in one, and it follows the book and stuff. And it is beautiful. Beautiful animations. The voice acting is like for the ages. MTI double gar, you know, and like it's so fun. I have beautiful memories as a child. That was another one of those that I had on the 8mm. So I didn't have the full extent of it, but I had some of the best parts. And then later on, we had the VHS, and that one I did watch over and over. It has so many messages. It has so many, you know, years later, I got this Tao of Pooh book that just kind of talked about all the philosophy in there. And it is amazing. It's just like, as a kid coping with change and loss and struggles, there were a lot of calming influences of that cartoon. And the way that Pooh just kind of rolled with the punches, even when he's like, the whole world is literally drowning out for him. That sequence with the Heffalumps and Woozles dream, it just like the Dumbo one, and it's probably same animators and stuff like that. It's done so well, and it's frightening and yet super creative. The song is great. The Tigger character is so fun. That's what you're talking about, like the different aspects of the same personality. I think all those characters, you could think of it that way, right? You have the rabbit, super careful. So you have the wisdom, you have the impulsiveness, you have the calm, you know, everything, the little child, everything. Love it.
Yeah. So what number are we on? Are we on number
two? That was three.
Oh, that was three.
That was three.
I already said my number two is Inside Out. Colin, what's your number two?
Mask of the Phantasm, which is a Batman animated film.
Oh, yes.
I would say by far and away the most well-written Batman movie. Now, my profound takeaway from this is you can confront the pain of your past and not become a monster. I would say that like takeaway is true for many a Batman film, but for some reason, this is the one that communicated it best. I think that I am also biased with this one because you can throw me literally anything Batman and I'll love it. I love everything from Batman and Robin, which by all accounts is like a poorly produced film with a lot of mistakes. And I also love the Nolan trilogy. I love the comics. I love a lot of the video games. There's all range of things that I love about Batman. But Mask of the Phantasm was, I think, cleanly executed. It was about a simple aspect of Batman's psyche, which is that he doesn't allow real romance, real connection into his life because of his choice to pursue justice and only justice, and to, which basically is a promise to, you know, the parents that he lost. And it's, and this movie is an extension of the animated series, which I'm going to guess, Kirk, that it possibly passed you by.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people who have deep affinity for Batman really loved the animated series because the stories are so well told and the villains get a lot of great stories, but there are also stories that don't have to do with the villains. And yes, the Joker, voiced by the phenomenal Mark Hamill,
Luke
one
Skywalker.
Of the best Jokers ever, he is in the film, but he's only in it where he serves it. They don't go, all right, now we got to do the Joker origin, even though they sort of haphazard, like they sort of backwards do give the Joker origin story, but it's not the point of the story. The point of the story is you've got Bruce Wayne, he's dealing with trauma, he's trying to figure out how to live, essentially, because, you know, Kevin Conroy gives this like defeated yet powerful voice to him. And it's just really lovely. And I really recommend anybody who's bored of Batman or doesn't like the new stuff, Batman v Superman and all that junk, try this out.
Cool. Number two, Birdo.
All right. By the way, good choice on that. I had on my honorable mentions, I actually had Lego Batman, which Kirk, you mentioned, was your favorite of the Lego of the Batman movies. I think Lego Batman's amazing. But I also agree that the animated series is fantastic. I haven't seen that movie, though. I'm now going to watch it, The Mask of the Phantasm. Okay, number two is... Oh, we already went through this one. This was Spirited Away.
Okay. My number one is Watership Down, as I said, 1978. I saw it as a kid. And it's, you know, same group of people that made Plague Dogs, but not as depressing or upsetting, but kind of depressing and upsetting. British.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, based on a 1972 novel by Richard Adams, considered to be the most violent animated PG-rated movie ever made, by the way. and it was just, I mean, I don't know if it... So I recently watched the Netflix version of it. Has anyone ever heard of the Netflix version that just came out last year? I loved that too a lot. And it's a mini series and they go more in detail. The animation is not as pretty in the least, but the story is told anyway, but the movie, the cartoon, I saw it as a kid and there was something about being so I don't know if, Colin, you and Berta, you tell me if this was your experience when you were growing up, but there's a lot of stuff marketed towards me in the 70s and early 80s that was like, okay, kids, you're small. We're gonna foist upon you stories about small animals or small things because you know you can relate to it. Was that your experience, Colin?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I, at some point, feel like it never... I wish that people would... tell, you know, these executives that is not the way, because it's about the story, really. I know you can say like, oh, well, kids are simpler and this and that or the other, but you can look at Disney's history of like which films were successful or not successful, and a lot of the ones that had animals were not successful, as successful. And while that isn't everything, because a lot of those have gone on to be cult classics, I think we just want to... I think kids also want to just connect with a character arc, and I think that people forget that, and they will slap on the superficial stuff, the fuzzy glove stuff.
Could be, yeah.
Yeah, well, so it wasn't only Disney, but it was books like Runaway Ralph was a book I read a lot as a kid. I don't know if people are familiar with it. It's about a mouse that finds a toy motorcycle, and somehow it runs, and he gets a helmet that he makes out of like a ping pong ball or something, and he has all these adventures on this farm while he is on this motorcycle. And there's just something about little animals... It was just really appealing to me. Anyway, so when I was watching Watership Down, watching these rabbits, it was very appealing to me because of that, but also because Bigwig is the tough guy. He's the biggest of the rabbits, and he has a big wig. He has like a tuft of hair on his head. That's why I call him Bigwig. And he was the tough guy. And when they brought him along because he was one of the guards and he would beat up people. Well, when I was 7 years old and 10 years old-ish, I was gigantic compared to my friends. And so when I saw this movie, I could definitely relate to being like, I'm the big one and I'm the one expected to beat up the enemies. And I'm the honorable one who puts his life on the line so that everyone can get away. And there was something really resonating for me at the age of 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. The movie also has an environmentalist angle that's very obvious. It's beautiful. The story is like nothing else. There's really, I can't think of anything else that is like Watership Down. So that's my number one. Colin, what's your number one?
My number one is The Little Mermaid. And my profound takeaway is you do not have to accept the love you were, quote unquote, designed for. So I know that The Little Mermaid gets a lot of flack because they talk about Ariel, you know, transforming to, you know, from mermaid into a human in order to fall in love with a guy and, you know, marry him at the end. I think that's a very reductive reading of the film because the love that she has at the beginning, before she even knows that Prince Eric exists, is for the human world. She's an inquisitive soul and she doesn't want to be a mermaid. In a lot of ways, she has always wanted to be a human. And I find that really inspiring because, you know, as a gay man, as a kid, I often thought, oh man, like in this society, I am not designed for the love that I want. Like I wish, I would tell my mom sometimes when she'd pick me up from swimming, like, I really wish I was a girl. And I was saying that, I feel like, in some ways, because I felt like that was my access. And I know that at the end of the day, Ariel isn't a Mulan. Love Mulan. She's wonderful. But Mulan, like, saves an entire country. Ariel essentially just is trying to figure her shit out. She's like she's a very relatable 16-year-old. I think people forget. She's 16. And most people, when they're 16, they're not saving the world. They are having crushes, fighting with their parents, and like getting into bad situations. And I think that Ursula, in a lot of ways, is like a metaphor for drugs, or just at least like temptation, at least. And so anyway, I think that in terms of the time, it's literally called The Little Mermaid. I find something quintessential about how limited, quote unquote, limited the story is, because there's a lot of relatability, as I said there, for me.
Yeah, it's interesting as we talk about how these movies resonate with us, and I'm realizing now that there's something about the cartoon movie art form that no matter how old you are, as you watch it, it taps into something very fundamental to our experience, almost pre-verbal. And, or at least it reminds us of things that were very profound to us as young people. Yeah. Not simple, not little, but like very big deals to us that we still have with us in part. I'm finding that, you know, because when I thought about doing this episode, I thought, okay, animated movies, that'll be fun. But as we talk about it, I'm really moved by how deep these movies are for us.
Yeah.
Birdo, number one, drum roll.
All right. Before I say the number one, a couple last honorable mentions. There's a movie called American Pop, which you might have seen. It was 1981. It's done in that same, what is that called, rotoscope style, like the, there were a few movies from the 70s, a few animated movies, that what they would do is they would film, and then someone would actually paint the frames.
The Lord of the Rings movie.
The Lord of the Rings, right. In fact, I think it's the same team.
Yeah.
Anyways, American Pop is this movie that takes you through the history of music in America, in the U.S., and it sort of like mixes fiction and nonfiction. Really interesting animation style. The second one of the ones I didn't mention, Triplets of Belleville.
Oh, yeah.
It's silent animation. Not silent, but like there's no talking you can understand. And yet it's just phenomenal. These this bicyclist, the cyclist in the Tour de France. He's trying to compete. He's trying to do it. And then he's struggling. And then there's these triplets that are old ladies and stuff. And then they end up like trying to like help him. It's really bizarre. It's kind of hard to describe, but if you watch it, it's entrancing. And then last of the honorable mentions is Ratatouille. It's like a really great movie. But my number one is Fantasia.
Oh yeah. You talk about this all the time.
Yeah. Fantasia, honestly, a lot of this has to do with the fact that I was little. I was taken to see it by my mom. I remember being terrified of Night on Bald Mountain, the big like monster comes out at midnight and stuff. But I also was fascinated by the dinosaur segment, and then Mickey and the Sorcerer's Apprentice is just one of the best things ever. The music, of course, this amazing classical music played by some of the best musicians of the time. And then I saw it in the big screen because she took me to the theater. So I was being exposed to this like godly music with the animation. The animation is some of the best animation ever done, ever. And granted, it's not one cohesive story. It's a whole bunch of different things. And so you kind of can't say like, well, you know, it's a great normal movie. But as far as animated movies go, that's my numero uno.
So I'm going to do my honorable mentions. There are a number of them. I'm just going to rattle through them. Coco is my number 11. So this is going from 11 to...
Yes.
So Coco, beautiful movie, tear jerky, interesting, funny. Box Trolls, which I often talk about. Love that movie. Megamind. Have you seen Megamind? With
no.
Will Ferrell?
Underrated.
Yeah, totally underrated. Megamind is hilarious. Tina Fey.
Oh, I have to see it.
Yeah, it is so good. And Brad Pitt.
What?
It has an interesting storyline. What's his face? I can't remember his name. Anyway. The Incredibles, of course.
Yes. Like I said, I could make a whole top 10 of Pixar movies, and none of y'all could say, like, you're wrong.
Right. The Iron Giant, of course.
Oh, thank you for mentioning that. I had those in honorable mentions.
Yeah. You haven't seen the Iron Giant?
Never seen it.
Oh, my goodness. So Iron Giant is unique and sad and interesting and beautiful.
Yeah.
You have to see Iron Giant.
I've heard it's
great. Uniquely beautiful. Mary and Max, which we talked about during our Charlie Kaufman
discussion. Such a sad movie.
But Mary and Max, I love stop motion, Charlie Kaufman. Nightmare Before Christmas, we talked about it. Kung Fu Panda, I love the Kung Fu Panda series.
Yes.
I think these movies are hilarious and, and interesting, and I just love everything that Jack Black does for the most part.
Yes.
Wreck-It Ralph.
Oh, yeah.
With John C. Reilly and Sarah Silverman.
I didn't like the sequel so much.
I liked the sequel. I did, but the first one is really good.
Yeah.
WALL-E, Spider-Man and the Spider-Verse, Sausage Party. I feel like Sausage Party
does not get
enough love. It is hilarious. It's interesting. Yeah. It's kind of poignant in a weird way.
Yeah.
I think it gets a bad rap because everyone thinks of it as like a...
Raunchy.
Yeah, raunchy, and it certainly is, but that's not the main, you know, thing of it.
Yeah.
Another underrated Disney movie is Tangled. I find
Tangled's great.
Funny and interesting.
And the music's awesome, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Any of your fans echo the same sentiments?
The Secret of Kells.
Nice.
Anyone seen The Secret of Kells?
No.
Love it.
Yeah.
It's a classic.
Interesting animation style and beautiful. And of course, Shrek. I mean, you can't say no to Shrek, the first one, and really all of them.
I can't believe I actually forgot Shrek. That should have been an honorable mention. That actually did something in its own right, which was like, oh, we can have like this
subversive
kind of humor.
And yeah.
Like, you can, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Make fun of Disney. Okay. Okay.
Right. Lego Batman movie, Nausicaa, another Miyazaki movie.
Yes.
I love Nausicaa. I don't know if you guys are going to laugh at me, but Legends of the Guardians, that owl movie.
I heard that's great. I haven't seen it, but I heard that's really good.
People make fun of it.
I like it.
But I actually really like that
movie.
Why
do people make fun of that?
I don't know.
That specific. That's there with Ponyo for me in terms of things I would project on my ceiling when I'm like relaxing.
But Legend of the Guardians is pretty violent. It's, you know, it's harrowing at times.
Yeah.
Not that, you know, I mean, in terms of, you know, contrasting it with Ponyo.
Oh, yeah. But different energy. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm glad that you like Legends of the Guardians. Brave. I love Pixar's Brave. I think I've rewatched it a number of times. Mm. I love her hair. I love the storyline. I love the comedy. I love the relationship between the daughter and the mother. Mm. I just really love them. Team America, we talked about. Team America. I mean, but you could argue it's not animation, but
yeah, I don't know about that one.
Yeah, Ratatouille. Okay, here's another one that people I think underrate, which is Turbo. Anyone seen the animated movie Turbo?
Does that have snails in it?
Yeah.
No, I've not. It, but
it is good. It is really good. Yeah. So it's about a snail that wants to become fast, and it's a really good movie. Okay. Metropolis, Japanese anime movie.
Ooh.
Very similar. It's almost like Akira, but more understandable and beautiful. Just a beautiful movie, Metropolis. Despicable Me. Can't go wrong with some Despicable Me. Millennium Actress, another anime movie. That's really great. Madagascar. I love the penguins. There's like a featurette with just the penguins that I'll watch periodically. I just love those guys. Triplets of Belleville, Toy Story 2, 3, and 4. Ralph Breaks the Internet. I actually do like Wreck-It Ralph 2. Coraline, of course. You can't go wrong with Coraline, which is made by the same people, I believe, that made Box Trolls.
Laika,
That's Neil Gaiman.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Portland, I believe, Oregon. Monsters vs. Aliens, another really great movie.
I never saw that.
It's really good. Yeah.
Yeah?
Wow. There's a movie called Nine from 2009.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
Oh, okay.
Sack People.
Yeah, really weird, but I like it.
It always reminded me of Tool because they had that video, remember? Yeah. With the,
yeah. Did it.
It's a great mood film.
Yeah. Rise of the Guardians, Christmas movie.
So isn't that supposed... Oh, wait, no. Ferngully is the one supposed to be the Avatar stole the plot from Ferngully, I think.
Okay.
Slash Pocahontas slash Dances with Wolves, yeah.
So Rise of the Guardians with Jack Frost and Santa Claus and...
Wait, so isn't Rise of the Guardians the owl movie? Wait, what?
No, Legends of the Guardians.
Oh, I see.
Of Gahul.
Okay.
Gahul.
So what's and then Rise of the Guardians?
Rise of the Guardians is Jack Frost and Santa and the Tooth Fairy... And it's a really good movie, and I've seen it a few times, and it's really great.
I don't think I had actually heard of this.
Epic is a movie about small people in the forest that I actually kind of like as well. Monsters, Inc. Mars Needs Moms. I kind of like that movie, too.
Wait, have you seen all these movies?
I have. The Good Dinosaur, I feel like, is a Pixar movie that does not get enough love.
Good. It's a good dinosaur
The Good
movie.
Dinosaur movie. Boss Baby is hilarious.
Oh, I love Boss Baby.
Yeah. Rango.
And they have a Blackbird sitting in the dead of night. Singing.
Yeah.
But that's his night song. I love it.
Rango with Johnny Depp.
That's funny.
I thought it was a pretty good movie. Rio.
Beautiful film.
Rio with Jesse Eisenberg. And Big Hero 6.
Oh, I forgot about... Oh, that should have been an honorable mention.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I was saying. I was like... So many, like Triplets of Belleville could have been in my top 10. Ratatouille, Good Dinosaur, Nine, Coraline, Box Trolls, Mary and Max, Iron Giant, Sausage Party, Tangled, Secret of Kells. Like these, all Lego Batman, like it's like, there's so many great cartoons.
By the way, even though I only honorably mentioned Ratatouille pulled a crazy stunt. Because it was another one of those, like Inside Out, where they could have had a, quote, cheaper ending and still been a great, entertaining movie.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't sure what believable thing they could do to make me think that they somehow won over the critic.
Right.
But they did. They managed to do that moment where it's like, of course, something that brings him back to his childhood with his mom cooking. Wow. And by the way, I think the Easter egg is, what I've heard is that that house is the house that Remy is from. That old lady, it was the critic's mom.
Oh.
But I haven't confirmed that, but that's the rumor.
Yeah. All right, Colin, what's your final word today?
Well, I had a couple of honorable mentions, so I'll just rattle them off. Once Upon a Forest, I watched a billion times when I was like two or whatever. Corpse Bride, love it.
Corpse Bride.
It's great. It's like, hey, if somebody doesn't love you, and it's okay, you can still love yourself. Like, there's other fish in the undead sea. There's the Iron Giant, of course, which is another, I think, kind of body dysmorphia film. Like, hey, you're not built for destruction. You decide who you are. Love it. Wind Rises, that's another Miyazaki. I find it to be a wonderful story about passion, but passion and facing adversity, and he has to work really hard because the world isn't going to help you.
Beautiful movie.
And The Rescuers, because those damn mice are just so cute.
Very cute.
And again, I think I sounded a little cold when I was ragging on animated films that have animals in them, but I think that what I was trying to say is that for me, what's more important than the subject of the animated film is the story that they're telling and how it's going to be like this thing that a child can relate to, even if they don't get all the story beats and they don't understand it for years. I think that it's a good idea to build a lot of depth into your animated movie. I'm talking to hypothetical producers out there, because your fans, whether they're 5 or 50, are going to be better off for it. And I guess my final word is that I'm looking forward to the next phase of animation, because we talked about Moana. I really feel like she's she's like Ariel 2.0, whereas she's this very driven female character who doesn't really have a love interest at all. I mean, she doesn't in the movie. I just recently watched Soul. I don't think it's quite as good as Inside Out, because it would be very hard to beat it, but that's not the point. You know, films, we always talk about competition, but it's really all of them have a place. But Soul is this wonderful story that just happens to have an African-American character at the center. So I really feel like we're going to just see more stories about a wider range of people. And animation is a great place for that, because every kid deserves to see themselves in an animated movie, whether they see themselves represented visually or if they project onto a bunny.
By the way, that was my point that I was making when we did the chess, the Queen's Gambit, and I got a lot of flack on the comments because people also, like you guys, or I don't know if you were calling, but Kirk didn't quite see my point.
Wait, so remind me?
What I was saying was that I just want to see more movies where the character just happens to be this, that, or the other, but it's not all about them being that. So like Colin was saying, Soul could have been about anyone, and it happens to be, you know, the main character is black. I want to see a lot more, just like you want to see a lot more Asians just represented, period. Same with me, I want to see Hispanics, I want to see women, I want to see all these things. So that's an example.
I think there was some other element, I can't remember what, to vibe that you were saying.
Well, yeah, because I was saying that like in the Queen's Gambit, and people disagreed, but I thought the big deal was that she's a female chess master. Imagine that, right? As opposed to like, she's a chess master. Oh, by the way, it's a female, but the point is that she's a chess master, right? And that's subtly different, but it's subtle. It's a big enough difference for me that I want to see more people that are just, what they are is irrelevant, but I want to see the representation.
Yeah. So comment below if you hate Birdo, and just really let him have it. And everyone out there, take care of yourself and enjoy those animated features. And let us know in the comments your top 10. And take care of yourself, because
you deserve it.
And don't underestimate the importance of body language.